This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 455 for March 8th of 2019, Corvette C8, Specs and Speculation. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
All right, everybody, we got a great show today. Gary, good seeing you.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
You're gallivanting around the world last week, and
right.
We were learning all about the history of Ford right here.
Yeah.
In an interesting show. So.
Yeah, good. We got to let everybody know the auto extremist is in the house, Peter DeLorenzo.
I'm back, yes.
He's back again. Yeah, good having you, man.
Good to be here.
And we should let everyone know our special guest today is Don Sherman. I guess we call you a freelancer? Or?
I'm a contributor, but I'm not that special. But thank you anyway.
For this show, you are. And we're going to be talking all about the new C8 Corvette, the mid-engine one. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, shoot us an email. Send it to viewermail@autoline.tv. Or we'll even take one of the phone calls. 620-288-6546 is that number. Remember, keep your questions short and to the point. We're far more likely to be able to ask them on the show if you do that. But anyway, Don, C8 Corvette. GM doesn't even admit that this car, at least officially, does not even admit that the car exists. And yet you got some pretty good intel on the thing. How do you dig this all up?
Well, 1,001 camo prototypes have been spotted. Mark Royce is pretty much acknowledged that there is a next-generation Corvette coming. And there's been a dozen concept cars built over the years. So there's no doubt that it's coming. There's some confusion as to exactly when. I stuck my neck out saying it would be at the Detroit Auto Show, and I think it was planned for that. But obviously it didn't appear. But I still believe it will be a 2020 model. It will be in production before year's end. It will be shown later this summer, and deliveries will begin in roughly 11 months from now.
They're going to have a fly-in press intro for it, aren't they?
My latest guess is it will be in conjunction with the 25th anniversary of the National Corvette Museum in Bowling Green. That happens at the end of August.
And they have that track there now.
There's a track there. It's got heavy GM involvement, investment. It's a good place. The weather can be trusted then. There's no competition from other things at an auto show. So that may be.
Yeah.
But again, it's speculation.
So what do you think you know about what this car will be?
I think it will be those things I said, plus begin with a pushrod engine, a starting price not too much beyond today's, between $60,000 and $70,000, overlap with C7 for a period because not everybody understands or wants a mid-engine car. It will be the first of a series with different powertrains coming over the years, just like C7, up to and including topping the 1,000 horsepower mark with hybrid, maybe eventually a pure electric. I don't know much about that, but certainly hybrids have been acknowledged, sort of a NSX in American trim.
You've mentioned GM has built several prototypes, concept cars, mid-engine Corvettes over the years.
One dozen.
A dozen, really? I had no idea that many.
This is 60 years in the making.
So why now?
I think the driver is because the owner body is aging. The last three generations have pretty much looked like each other. And performance is at a bit of a stalemate. The more power you put up the front, the faster you burn down the back tires. So how do you rectify that? It's not with traction control. It's with changing the physics. And the physics are strongly in favor of putting the engine back there. You improve launch traction. You improve braking into turns. You reduce the polar moment. You let it be more, make it more responsive turning in. And when you're done turning, more responsive going straight again. So, you know, race cars have known this for 90 years. And other mid-engine sports car makers have known this forever. And Zora discovered it about 60 years ago. Not from the physics. I went to his home, Zora Arkadyshenkov.
The father of the Corvette.
Sort of.
Okay.
He was the first chief engineer, and you could say he's the godfather. Or okay, let's call him the father. Okay. I said, Zora, I went there with one question. Why are you so fascinated with mid-engine? And he reflected on a failure at Sebring in 1957.
With the SS.
Corvette SS. They literally cooked John Fitch. His conclusion from that was heat should be behind the driver, heat source. Get the engine, instead of heating up the cockpit and the floor and the body with exhaust pipes, get it out of the way, put it in the back. I think once he made that leap, he discovered all the physics. He would have known them anyway, because he grew up in Germany. He watched Auto Union and Benz race mid-engine cars. So he probably knew the physics in the back of his mind. But once you start down mid-engine path, where else are you going to go?
So why did it take 60 years, though? I mean, if he knew this back then, and we've had seven generations of Corvette, I mean, okay, we'll say we had six because the first one was what it was, which started
it
all.
You can count it.
But I'm just saying that, I mean, so...
He tried hard. He tried hard with serves.
Serve one and serve two.
There's 12.
Chevrolet...
Engineering research vehicle.
Yeah.
And those were quasi-race cars. Those were his race experiments. It was going to be Formula One-type race car, then a Can-Am-type race car. But they were experiments. But he couldn't sell it through marketing and the GM hierarchy. And when
there's the serve, too.
When he left, he passed it on to Dave McClellan with the words, Dave, you must build mid-engine. McClellan failed, too. He didn't try as hard, but he sort of bucked the politics in the company best he could. Same with Dave Hill. Finally, though, about 10 or 12 years ago, a believer in the form of Tad Zeuchter came along. Not as chief engineer, but he made a case for it. And he sold it to Lutz. He sold it to the chairman at the time. It was slated for production. Then the bankruptcy hit, and it went away. Corvette, everything went away. GM went away. And when it came back, it would be risky to start up Corvette again with mid-engine, so they did C7 instead.
So, Peter, why from your experience, I mean, with the Serv 1 and the Serv 2, and presumably these things worked out all right, there obviously was no impetus behind going forward with that stuff.
Well, you have to remember Zora was an outsider, inside outsider. I mean, he was a maverick. I mean, the famous clash with Bill Mitchell over the split window Stingray. Zora did not want that split in the back in 63. Mitchell won the battle, but Zora won the war because the next year it was gone. And there was always a clash between the state upper management of General Motors and the true believers of Chevrolet Engineering. And they were always way out front. Yeah. And when they couldn't have an outlet, they teamed up with Jim Hall. And basically the Chaparrals was a factory GM racing effort. And that was their outlet. But as far as transferring, and they did some beautiful mid-engine cars. The Aerovet was my favorite, which still looks stunning today.
They did Wankel-powered cars. They did aluminum body cars.
Yeah.
There were 12 in all. There was a Cadillac CN. There was one in Australia. And there just wasn't a groundswell that they could detect from customers saying, we got to have a mid-engine Corvette. And customers are more mature. They play golf. They appreciate the value. A lot of them are interested in performance, but a lot of them are not. My neighborhood's full of these guys, and they're typically 60 years old. You say mid-engine to them, and a blank stare comes across their face. But you can't cling to it forever, the old way, I believe.
Well, the difference, they almost had one, as Don said, and then the bankruptcy hit. That was a green-lighted project, and then they shelved it. And I think the difference is they made a business case, and everyone said, oh, the mid-engine Corvette's going to be $170,000, blah, blah. No, it isn't. It's going to be within very much reason of the current car and price. And as soon as GM figured out how to do that, that's when the program was green-lighted by Royce.
So, Don, the chatterers in the chat room are wondering if you work for GM, or how do you come by all your information on the C8?
I've got a advanced network of sources, including Peter DiLorenzo. And I poll suppliers.
Ratted you out.
Peter knows. When you ask a supplier, let's say Brembo, for example, are you working on mid-engine Corvette? They don't say yes. But you watch their eyes. Their eyes react. They don't deny it. They've been working on it forever. And it's reinforcements of that type. And there are leakers from inside GM. There's a mid-engine Corvette blog.com place that has 2,000 members. So there's regular news from them, including this very week, one of them captured a fleet of 6 mid-engine Corvettes in camo in Yuma, Arizona, with Mark Royce in the passenger seat smiling back at the camera. So it's no secret.
Not to mention the footage of the racing cars, Pratt & Miller built mid-engine Corvette racing cars that have been running for 6 months.
Yeah, there's video on YouTube right now of those cars at the Nordschleife at the Nürburgring, at Sebring as well. And I think maybe I'm thinking of the one that you talked about. No, it couldn't be.
They've run them at Road America, too.
Okay.
I did get one tidbit this morning from an impeccable source.
Here's one of the heavily camoed ones.
It's not that heavy. It's just a paint job.
Yeah, from an impeccable source that said it came in a question how many parts are shared from the C7 to the C8. I said, you got me. And he said, one. Wouldn't tell me which
one. Some switch. I've heard the same thing.
It's just a switch.
Okay, the parts aren't shared, but they're just shuffled. That doesn't mean they're more expensive. It's got a transaxle.
No.
It's got an engine. It's got suspension stuff. Of course, it's a leap forward in technology where possible, but and there are investment costs for tooling, et cetera, but they know how to do it. They've got the engines more in-house now. They got a fresh paint shop that's probably vastly more efficient. They've got the ability to build 7 and 8 together interspersed on the line. So, you know, they've had ample time to figure this out.
Yeah.
So do you guys think that Ford forced their hand going mid-engine with the new GT, which has been a real halo for the brand, won Le Mans its first year into it and all?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, this battle's been going on internally at GM, as Don said, for 60 years. And I think, they looked at the Ford GT and said, that's cool and all that. But they had to come to terms with it, their own history, their own heritage. And, you know, even though it wasn't out front in the open, I mean, GM has a glorious history of factory-supported racing programs, and the Chaparral was example number one. And I just think that the Ford, they look at that as that's Ford's deal, but you know, they had to come to terms with their own.
Yeah.
Look at the price and volume on the Ford GT, and I must offer a correction. They didn't win Le Mans. They won a class.
A class, exactly.
Hey, 50 years ago, sure, they won Le Mans.
Right.
I give them full credit.
Right.
It's one of the many mid-engine cars I got to drive over the years that convinced me this is it. I've known this for 50 years when I started this enthusiasm.
So what do you think led them to pull the trigger this time? Is it having Royce in there who is a true car guy or what?
It's having it's sort of getting out of bankruptcy. It's having Royce a believer. It's having a business case where it can be profitable. It's having Tadz Euchter. And like I say, the C7 customers are aging. They're not going to last forever. You got to get the next generation. You got to get the Countach photo on the wall in the bedroom of the 15-year-olds. So when they get to be 20 and start a .com, they buy a Corvette instead of a Ferrari.
But wasn't the C7 supposed to solve that problem?
Why? How could it?
Well, it looked radically different than the C6. It looked more like almost like a Japanese manja sort of car in terms of its sheer planes and design than any Corvette
it's
did.
It's different from C6, correct. And former chief engineer Dave McClellan called it morphed from the C8 design. So it's a preview, potentially a preview of C8 surface execution and things. Those were his words, the word morphed. I hope C8 has more beauty than C7. I see C7 as the beast. I want C8 to be the beauty, and I want it to be my car. I have a deposit on one. But if it's not beautiful, if I don't love it, I'm going to cash out my deposit.
So, Peter, why does Chevrolet have a Corvette?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, way back when they did the original, which was a show car, the 53.
Yes.
It really didn't have a reason for being either, but it ended up at Chevrolet.
Harley Earl wanted one for...
Yeah. I've been advocating to have Corvette be its own division for years now.
I agree with you on that.
And, they could take the V-Series Cadillacs, which kind of are orphaned within the Cadillac brand, and morph them into Corvettes like Porsche's done. Porsche's done a masterful job. I haven't exactly agreed with all of it, but they're printing money, so... it's stayed under the auspices of the Chevrolet brand, I think, just for sheer inertia all these years. And every time I talk to someone about a separate Chevrolet or Corvette division, they're just like, they go white and they... wander off.
Muttering.
Yeah, muttering. And so.
There's a halo effect, not only, of course, for Chevrolet, but for GM. And the halo works two ways. The prestige of a brand, and it's a destination for kids to stay working here, not go to Silicon Valley, to want to really work on something world-class, something Ferrari-like in America. So I think that's a good reason for it to exist, whether it's a Chevrolet or just a Corvette by itself.
Jarrett Allen wrote in to say the C8 seems really cool, or he thought it was really cool, until he found out there would be no manual transmission. Why?
Well, there's no manual transmission in a Ferrari. And the why is because it's hard to make a business case with two transmissions. And dual clutch is kind of the future of everything, where you get the performance, you don't have to have the skill, you don't have to certify and build two. And I'm sorry to see the clutch pedal go away, but it's just a fact of life today.
Don, are they going to build both C7 and C8s? Are they going to keep one as sort of like an entry Corvette and the C8 the step up?
Corvette classic.
My speculation is yes, because there's demand for C7. It may taper off. It may be tapering off now as people are depositing on 8 instead of buying 7s. So my theory is that they will wait and see. How do customers like C8 when they see it in the flesh? Remember when C7 happened, a lot of people went out and they didn't like it. They're conservative. They don't like a shift away from round taillights. They didn't like covered headlights. So they bought the previous car for a while. Then they came around when they saw them on the street. I think that's just the nature of Corvette buyers.
Let's see. We've got a number of phone calls here. Carmen, let's bring in one of them.
This is Clem Zarovsky at Belmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, will the new C8 Corvette have coilover suspension or will it still have the cross buggy springs? Thank you.
A CAD drawing leaked from presumably from GM showed very clearly coilover in the front. And I studied the rear in detail, didn't see any spring shock absorbers. I don't think there's room for what you're calling buggy springs. Those are very efficient. They're light.
Made of plastic.
Fiberglass.
Transverse spring, right?
Right.
I own a 67 Corvette, and I traded out the multi-leaf rear spring for one of those and saved 70 pounds.
Man.
That one part. And it's adjustable. So it makes good sense. People think they're buggy springs. It doesn't have much prestige. So I don't think that's made the leap to C8.
There's been a delay in the program. Like you said, you thought it was going to be introduced at the Detroit Auto Show this year. So did so many other people. Didn't happen. The word that came out is that it had electrical problems. Somebody else told me, no, that's electrical. And they said electrical is just a euphemism for heating problems. And there can be heating problems with a mid-engine car.
My sources say that all GM products are making the leap in global electrical architecture from A to B, including Corvette. It's causing a lot of issues and problems. That's one reason for a potential delay, why it wasn't shown in Detroit. Another issue I've heard is that the 1,000 horsepower powertrain or thereabouts distorted the aluminum space frame. And that requires some
oops.
Hey, when that happens.
Some help. And there's another third issue, which I can't put a finger on. There's some friction between design and the user, engineer, enthusiast side of the picture. It could be visibility. It could be the cockpit design. It could be the shape of the steering wheel. But Tadge is serious enough that he wants to resolve that. But I think that's the reason why it wasn't shown in Detroit. What's the hurry? They want to get it right and not have to recall, not have to fix things. So they're taking their time on it.
Interesting thing. This goes to the racing program. Corvette Racing is going to run the C7 at Daytona next year and Sebring and at Le Mans.
Next year?
I mean, this year.
This year. Yeah.
Yeah. And the reason for that is Ford pulled the wool over the French for the 24-hour Le Mans, the Ford GT. They wanted it to run in the 50th anniversary. And they made the French all these promises. Oh, we're going to have it in production in August, and it'll just be a few months. It wasn't in production for a year after that. So the French told Corvette Racing, now, when we see the car, you can race it. But, I mean, so Ford screwed it up for everybody.
Well, I had also heard that with the WEC, you cannot change cars in the middle of a season. Whatever you start the season with is what you got to run the whole season with.
Yeah, so Corvette Racing isn't going to show up with the C8 till Daytona in 2020,
mm-hmm.
which and it's, is to me too bad.
All those performance adjustments, it's probably favorable for a strong finish on C7 because they know the benefits of 8. They know what Ford did. They're not going to give them any break out of the box, so might as well stay with the proven quantity.
Let me ask a question that I'm going to have both of you jump up and pummel me for asking. So General Motors is spending a tremendous amount of money engineering this vehicle, the likes of which they have never made in production before, correct? And we're talking about something that's going to cost roughly 70, 80 grand, right?
Roughly, okay. Maybe less.
Or maybe more. We don't know, right? So no. Here's the question. When you have one of their competitors, Porsche, pouring lots of money and lots of effort into the Taycan, which is an electric vehicle, which will be a performance vehicle. Why isn't General Motors doing that, and why are they doing a Corvette? Why are they not doing a full-out electric Corvette right out of the box?
Well, I think further out in the development of the C8, you're going to see hybrid, and then you're going to see an all-electric one eventually.
Defending GM's honor, they're the global leader in electrification if you look at history. EV1, Volt, Bolt, did they make money? Did they recall them and crush them? Did they get blamed for killing the electric car? But what did Mary Barra say? We're going electric. Mark Royce has said it.
So that's my question. Why aren't they going electric
today? They have Chevrolet Bolt. Buy one if you'd like. It's pure electric.
I understand that.
It's way ahead of the Taycan and anything Porsche or VW has done. It's a pretty good product.
I think the leap to the mid-engine configuration is one thing. I think if they not only did that, but say, okay, here it is, it's all electric, that would have killed the car.
I agree completely. Phase into it.
Yeah.
They're the last adopters.
And like we were talking about Formula E. I've tried, but part of the thrill of racing is the feeling in your gut.
Visceral sound, thunder.
And you're watching and you're hearing slot car noises from your youth, and it's just nothing for me.
But Formula One doesn't have a good sound either to me.
No,
I
can't.
It's got a bit of a buzz.
I can't stand Formula One. I mean, they need to go back. Like, I've written this a bunch of times in my motorsports column, bring back the scream.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you go to a Formula One race. You go there and you just go, oh, my God, this is awesome. Now it's just like, UPS trucks, twin turbo UPS trucks.
The smart electric car producers will have artificial soundtracks. When you rev it up, it makes noise. Noises you like, noises you can adjust. You can have this one, this one, this one. But it won't be totally silent. It won't be a hum or a whir.
That's where Formula E's missed the boat. Now, in 2007, when I proposed the Hydrogen Electric Racing Federation, right in the rules was every manufacturer had to have their own sound signature, which can be a combination of amplified noise and wind going over the car, which creates a noise. And all the manufacturers were like, yeah, that's cool. Formula E, they don't do that. I mean, yeah. If Porsche and Mercedes are going to go into Formula E, they should dial in some sound to their cars so that they sound different. I mean,
so they sound like race cars.
Yeah.
It's slot cars.
Yeah. So.
Hey, another viewer wrote in, Doc Wolf. I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but he's saying he thinks that the reason they went to, as he points out, a rear mid-engine Corvette is the Camaro's gotten to be so good. He said their performance profiles overlap a great deal and present the Camaro as a bargain alternative. He says this takes away from Corvette sales and status. So that's why they had to justify the C8 as being fundamentally different. You buy that, Don?
No.
Okay.
Camaros aren't selling great. I think the Camaro needs to be on a fresh track where you can actually see out of it and it doesn't look like a...
I think the Camaro design was the first major miss by GM design in a while.
I agree.
I think that the look of the car is terrific. The drive of the car is terrific. But compared to the Mustang, you feel like you're sitting in a bathtub. There's no trunk space and absolutely no rear seat space. So even though it's a terrific looking, here we got a picture of it, and driving car, for people who want something as an everyday driver, they're going to go with the Mustang instead of the Camaro.
You could advance it if you have to keep that 69 look, advance it a model year to the 70 and drop the belt line. I think the problem would be solved.
Well, they had two proposals. One was this one and one was more like the 70. I would have gone with the 70.
Me too. Those are handsome cars.
Yeah.
And to be fair to the Camaro team, the sales loss of Camaro last year was 25%, which is the same as it was for Corvette, so...
Okay, give us some Mustang figures.
Well, you know, these are U.S. figures, too. Remember, Mustang now has a steering wheel available on the right-hand side for markets that need that. And Ford's done a decent job of exporting them. I don't think it would boost these numbers completely, but Gary,
well,
what do you
have Mustang
there?
Was only down 7.4% and considerably outsold Camaro.
And Challengers sell remarkably well, purely on horsepower and tradition, right, basically, and, you know, astute marketing. They look very traditional.
Yeah.
So we had 76,000 Mustangs, 51,000 Camaros.
Yeah, and the 76,000 Mustangs, I'll bet it's probably more like 86,000 to 90,000 when you include exports.
Somewhere I have.
And you're right, Challenger's done pretty good. In fact, there's a new Challenger coming this year, or supposed to be coming this year.
Challenger 67,000, and it was actually up 3%.
Yeah.
Horsepower and right. marketing.
Brilliant marketing with the Hellcat and the Demon. They really
they've got a new
the Dodge Brothers.
They've got a new marketing right. campaign now
for those cars.
For the performance go was it a Muscle City or Muscle Car City or something? I've only seen it a couple times. I like it.
They show them here plowing through snowbanks, for Christ's sake.
I could see having a Challenger, normally aspirated Challenger with all the stuff on it. I don't need that. Normally aspirated motor would be fun to have.
Hey, we got to take a commercial break right now. Give a shout out to the sponsors that make the show possible. We've got more questions from the audience, more phone calls. We got Dr. Data coming up, and we'll be back in just a moment.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an industry leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back, and this is the part of the show where Dr. Data presents his number.
All right, so this has absolutely nothing to do with anything we've talked about thus far. Zero. Okay, just want to make that clear. So I was looking at some interesting numbers in terms of sales. Huh, what a surprise. That went on the in January. So, Katie, could you please bring up the first thing? Okay, so in the month of January, in terms of passenger vehicle sales in China, only one brand has double-digit market share. One brand. And then we're going to give you a clue, okay? And so, Katie, bring up the second slide. It's not Trumpchi. I knew that's what you're going to guess, Peter, but I just thought I would get that right out of the way. Trumpchi had a 1.6% market share.
Chinese brand?
Any brand
in China,
month of January, only one out of the multitude of available vehicles, brands.
Okay, I thought Volkswagen was the biggest in China, so I'm going to guess Volkswagen.
Done.
Tesla.
Cadillac.
And the answer is?
Buick was my second choice.
Volkswagen.
13.3%. I mean, and it's interesting. I mean, it's like those guys are, I don't know if I'd go to the extent of saying head and shoulders, but if you think about it, I mean, there's only one that's double digits. Toyota is actually comes in second at 7.8%. So it's rather remarkable that Volkswagen, a German brand, is just like hammering it over there.
And these are VW cars, not the whole fleet of under the VW group.
VW cars, yeah.
VW brand, yeah. Not the AG, Audi, and Porsche.
That VW buggy is so cool.
So this is the Geneva thing that they introduced, the dune buggy?
Yeah, it's cool. Coolest thing about it is they said, and we're going to design it so that enterprising car people can pull the body off and build their own bodies on it.
Yeah, here we got a picture of it.
Well, I thought I read that basically Volkswagen itself said that it would maybe have that contract manufactured for them rather than manufacturing it themselves. And so they basically, you know, would have the MEB skateboard that...
Interesting.
That would...
Well, Volkswagen's getting interesting. They're going to have the bus, and then they're going to have this. And...
Let's see if they actually do it. And this is kind of interesting. I mean, it's sort of like a Myers-Manx, maybe more like the second generation of it. I wonder if Stuart Reed at Art Center had any hand in it, because he did the second generation Myers-Manx.
Bruce Myers has probably followed suit already.
It could well be.
So, Peter, did you see anything else that came out of Geneva that caught your eye?
I like PX's personal car that they're denying he's the owner or the buyer, but the one-off Bugatti.
Is that the $12.5 million one?
19.
Oh, I'm sorry. When you go slumming, you get the $12.5 million one.
A very particular Bugatti enthusiast, and it's already leaked out that it's PX. And they said it's probably going to take 3 years to get built.
So what did you think of the Pininfarina Battista?
I thought it was interesting. I would have liked to see it in person, but I thought it was interesting.
So there's one that would have 1,874 horsepower.
1,000 is just the new...
It's the new 300.
Yeah, it is.
But it's an EV, so it has wheel motors that... We'll be driving it like that, and it seemed like a lot of vehicles that were coming out of there that had high horsepower, very high prices, but there's some normal-ish things. Mazda with the CX-30.
I thought the new Ferrari was nice looking.
Yeah. So is. With all of the exotic cars, you know, that Aston Martin showed three cars. Koenigsegg.
Aston's really teetering close to being vaporware at this point.
Well, you know, anything made in England
Brexit's
is in
killing
deep
them.
Trouble.
Yeah,
Jag
deep
especially.
Trouble. Jaguar, which a year ago looked brilliant, has fallen flat on its face now. I just read Bloomberg was reporting Tata, which is the owner, is looking at trying to get other investors now to join in and put money into it. So it's,
Are they going to vote on Brexit again? I thought.
No.
No?
They've got, like, till the end of March.
It's going to probably destroy the British car industry.
It's going to destroy it. It's going to destroy it within a matter of years. You know, Honda has said it's pulling out in 2022. Nissan has said we're not allocating any new product
right.
to the plant.
You know, that's the biggest car-making plant in England is the Sunderland plant that Nissan has. And so not to put new vehicles in there?
Yeah, and Toyota, which heretofore has been very quiet about Brexit, has said, hey, guys, we don't see how we can stay here if this happens. BMW just came out in the last couple of days saying we're going to have to pull Mini production out of England. It's like, yow. The only thing that's going to be left is Rolls-Royce at this rate.
Bentley.
Maybe Bentley, yeah. Because their prices are so high. So what if you add a few more?
Kudos to the Rolls-Royce marketing team for the headline on the Cullinan and the Rolls-Royce of SUVs.
The thing looks like a brick, though.
Well,
I don't think it looks attractive, and they can't build them fast enough.
I remember saying, you'd all know I won a lottery because I'd get a ghost. A gray ghost.
So speaking of performance, Volvo announced that they're going to be limiting the speed of their vehicles to 112 miles per hour
this
maximum.
This is the most boneheaded thing. I mean, why? What's the point?
They shouldn't have announced it.
No, they shouldn't have
done it. who uses 112 miles an hour, even where there aren't speed limits?
Mm-hmm.
Not many go 112. And car magazines don't even test it anymore. Car and Driver wimped out on top speed testing because they just print manufacturer numbers. It's less trouble for them.
Yeah, in the old days, as Don, you well know, you put the little word observed.
Yeah. But don't you think, look, this is all about publicity. This is all about Volvo saying, see how much we care about safety? We're limiting the speeds of our cars. That's what it's about.
You can kill yourself pretty well at 112 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah.
Without
you
much trouble.
Kill yourself
half that
at
speed.
35 if you do it wrong.
Well, look, all the crash tests are done at 40 miles an hour. You know, bury your impact and all that, so why not limit it to that? Then you know no one's going to get killed in it.
See, I thought it was interesting. So I'm driving a Buick Avenir, which is, you know, a three-row SUV Enclave, and I looked at the speedometer. It goes to 170. Like, why?
Well, and don't forget, there was a period where, I forget the years, but the speedometers would only go up to 85.
Yeah, that was limited by law.
Yeah, and I don't want to see those days. If your Avenir goes up to 170 on the speedo, that's great. But I don't want to see 85.
But that's a good question. Don, why do you think? Why do all speedometers, with the exception of when they were limited to 85 mph by law, they all go list way above the car's
top speed? I think it's graphic balance.
But you could just spread the numbers.
Yeah, right.
No, you need graphic
balance. Oh, come on. Yeah. You're going to say it's the kerning of the...
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Witless customers believe it will achieve that.
They
not
do.
In their hands, but... And it's part of its bar bragging rights. My speedometer goes faster than yours does.
It's like Jerry Maguire. It's the Quan.
Yeah, look at this one, 210. Like, that's... kilometers, though, yeah. That's
my pet peeve more than that is having a tachometer with no red line. I hate that. What's the point of the tach if there's no red line? Because you're going to use that. I'm going to use it. Mm-hmm. I want to know.
Most people are probably wondering what the hell that thing is over there.
Yes, they are.
So,
would you call that, Peter, visual balance? No.
Term you just came up with.
I don't know. What I said.
Oh, well, we'll rewind the tape and figure it out and maybe make that the title of today's show.
Well, yeah, I could just hear an interior designer at GM. So it's visual balance.
Visual balance, that's it. What else you got there, Gary?
Well, so this was a... we were talking a lot about General Motors earlier. So I guess we would say the first shoe dropped this week with the closing of the Lordstown, Ohio assembly plant.
That's devastating in that area.
Yeah.
I've been doing a lot of interviews from Ohio TV stations and stuff. It's devastating down there.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, here's a bunch of people, by and large. Most of them showed up to work every day, did an honest day's work, thought they were doing the right thing, and their jobs yanked out from under them.
Think about how that spreads, you know, restaurants, bars, and convenience stores, and cleaners, dry cleaners. I mean,
it's part of it's the UAW not being world class competitive. The wages are just too high, and you can't sustain it. GM can't stay in business paying those high wages and competing with lower wages in southern states where there's less union.
Well, in the old days, GM would have been criticized. They would have not done anything, and then reacted. Now they're out in front of it and they're getting killed in the media. But, you know, I think Mary Barr is, you know, she's doing the responsible thing for the company, but the human toll is
pretty bad.
Yeah.
But having said that, you know, GM has found jobs for almost all those people, all but 100 of them. Now, the bad news is you have to go to some other GM plant. That might involve going to another state. That means you got to rip up roots and move. In fact, you may have to leave the family behind until you can sort things out. So even though GM is saying we've got jobs for these people, it's still tough.
Yeah.
And I've seen firsthand how this happens, especially if you have seniority and you can bump somebody else out at another plant. And so now the plant that you go to, everyone's pissed off because you bumped their buddy out. And now you're there, and it just creates a lot of bad blood.
Is the elimination of Lordstown an indication of the fact that small sedans are just not selling and they just really don't have much of a future?
I think that contributed somewhat, but at the same time, the other manufacturers seem to think that cars are still worth building. And who's picking up the slack? Toyota, Honda, Kia, Hyundai.
It's ruthlessly competitive in the survivors. There's many choices. And Cruze is a pretty good car. It's not by my gauge, a small car. It's a very roomy, five-passenger, perfectly family-suitable car. But there's many Japanese and very fine Korean competitors to deal with, many of which don't pay those high UAW wages to build.
I wouldn't put it completely on the UAW wages.
Not completely.
I think there's other things, work rules, especially when it comes to skilled trades people that are totally uncompetitive. And so, you know, if you look at the wages certainly that Toyota and Honda pay, they're pretty damn competitive. I mean, one of the ways to keep the UAW out of your plant is to pay wages that are almost there, not completely there. But I think the real thing is, I looked at it, GM has 18 assembly plants in North America. I'm counting two in Oshawa, because there's Oshawa 1 and Oshawa 2. So there's 18 assembly plants. And if I look at all the vehicles that GM sells in North America, they need 15 assembly plants. So you've got three plants right now, Lordstown, Oshawa 1 and 2, and Detroit Hamtramck, that are running at essentially 30% manufacturing capacity. I don't know the numbers. I guarantee you they're bleeding red ink. As you guys know, you don't hit break even until you get to around 80% manufacturing capacity. So if you're operating at 30, these are big-time money losers. And to your point, Peter, in the old days, it would have been, oh, well, you know, we can't do anything about it until you face bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And they're not going to go down that path again.
No, they're not.
Well, you know, one of the things that the workers have no input on in any meaningful way is the design and engineering of a vehicle. So, you know, you were mentioning Toyota and Honda, for example, and Peter, you mentioned Hyundai and Kia with product. And so the question is, you know, were the workers at Lordstown given a product that is truly competitive with, you know, country of origin notwithstanding? I mean, if you just, you know, object to object to object, is it competitive?
Well, as Don said, I think the Cruze is a fine car.
You want us to do a comparison test here on the spur of the moment? It's very difficult to do. That said, I just helped buy a used Chevrolet Cruze for my son and his wife. They're quite content with it. We didn't shop much. We bought it through auction wholesale. But it's a good car. I was impressed how solid it is. It goes straight. It's got good structure. Looks reasonably attractive. But there's just so many alternatives.
See, I just sort of wonder, I mean, if you look at it, so, you know, Peter, as you're mentioning, like, okay, Ford is deciding that cars are not that important to its future, right? Chrysler has basically decided that with the exception of, say, muscle cars, I mean, we saw how long did the Dart last in the market?
Or the 300, even less.
But, I mean, it's just like...
I meant the 200.
Right.
Yeah, it's all Jeeps and all Rams all the time
right.
now.
Right. So if you look at those, like... You know, whether it's General Motors or Ford or FCA, I mean, they're completely unassailable in the truck space, right? I mean, and we've seen, you know, the sales of the Toyota trucks are nothing. The sales of the Ridgeline are pathetic. You'd be hard-pressed to find a Titan outside of Nashville, I think. I mean, it's just like, but these other, you know, so these other companies are trying, but they're not succeeding. But they're succeeding in the cars in the way that the traditional Detroit 3 are not succeeding in cars. I mean, is there something to that?
But car volume total is down substantially. And there are many feeders at that trough, at a smaller trough. So there's got to be losers. And I'll give you two questions. Why is everybody buying crossovers? That's the first one. Second one, what's the next big thing? Crossovers aren't going to be it forever. There's going to be something else. It's up to somebody to invent it. And maybe it's electrics. Maybe it's the Ford Mach-E. I don't know what it is. But I don't like crossovers myself.
But Gary, I think you nailed it. I think when it comes to people who are interested in traditional passenger sedans, that kind of buyer is not that interested in what GM, Ford, and Chrysler have to offer. Far more interested in especially the Japanese and Korean imports. And getting back to your question about Lordstown, if they put the Chevrolet Blazer, let's you know, wind back the tape 3 to 4 years and GM decides, guess what? We're just going to build the Cruze in Mexico. That's it. And we're going to put the Blazer into Lordstown. I believe that plant would be open. Or Blazer Plus, you know, just like Ford with the Wayne assembly plant in Michigan said, you know, Focus and C-Max ain't going to make it. So they put the Ranger in there, but they're also going to put the Bronco in there. You need at least two products in a plant, I think, to make sure that it's going to be viable in the long run. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one other thing I think we should mention about Lordstown, which most people don't remember, is it was built, the assembly plant was built to make the Chevrolet Vega. And it was designed to make them at 100 an hour, not the 60 an hour everybody in the business had done. And if you remember at the time, this would have been very early 70s, this is when the whole concept of blue-collar blues entered the media. And you had a lot of hand-wringing. Oh, manufacturing's terrible. You know, factory jobs are abysmal. You don't want your children to go into that. I think you can tie the decline in manufacturing in the U.S., certainly automotive industry, with the lack of interest of anybody going into the plants to all those stories that came out of Lordstown with the blue-collar blues, running the line too fast, everybody hating their jobs, and now they're all, you know, crying that this plant's going to close.
And they were replaced by automation doing a lot of those drudgery jobs. A lot of them are inspectors or machine operators, those who survived. They're not spot welders anymore.
Right. That's all robotics. Hey, we got a couple of more phone calls here. Carmen, let's bring them in.
Hello, this is John down in Burlington, North Carolina. Just calling to see if by chance they ever explored mid-engine front four-wheel drive. Thank you, guys. Wonderful show. Y'all have a good one. Bye.
Do you know, Don?
Zora designed and patented a four-wheel drive thing that had a transverse engine, and the power went in circles, and it went to the back and the front. And there was an engineer who built some of them. I can't remember his name. He went to IMSA from GM, you probably recall. I think his first name was Dave. But it's really not necessary in my book from a traction standpoint. And the benefits of weight versus complexity versus traction versus performance, to me, don't pan out. That changes when you go electrification, where you don't have to have shafts linking both ends. You can have motors at one end. So that's when we're going to see that, I believe, in C8.
Good deal. And I think we've got one last phone call here. Carmen, let's bring that one in.
Hi, John. This is Dale Leonard out of Cleveland, Ohio. And this message is for Peter. Glad to see the auto extremist making another appearance on After Hours. And hope that this is a sign of the times and you'll be making many more. Great show as always. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Dale.
Great. Yeah, thanks for that, Dale.
Props to you.
Not a question, but...
Yeah. So I've got a question for you, Peter. Okay.
Why?
Because you're there. So Elon Musk has announced that he's no longer going to have many physical Tesla stores. Some apparently will remain, but by and large, they'll be gone. Okay. Do you think there would be a future in being able to market and sell vehicles purely over the internet?
Yeah, but probably not Tesla. You know, I think he's presiding over the downward spiral of his company. I mean, he's made some completely bonehead moves. I mean, he's got some dealers out there who've spent millions on these facilities, and all of a sudden he's going to say, I don't want to do that anymore. I'm just going to sell them direct. Well, there are people all over the country who can't get their Tesla serviced. If anything he should be doing, he should be building Tesla service centers so that people can actually get their car serviced instead of loading them up on a trailer in Michigan and having them trailer down to Ohio. I mean, I don't know what he's doing. I think he should stick to rockets. Stick to rockets.
You know, he's mentioning that and mentioning Ohio. I've got hundreds and hundreds of emails in my box that I never pay any attention to. And I was going through the other day and I found one that came out on February 19th. Okay, so this is before that was announced, that basically a brokerage house was announced it was selling the Tesla retail property located at 5180 Mayfield Road, Lyndhurst, Ohio, for $6 million. So, I mean, this was evidently in the works already, and I have a feeling that's the dealership that Henry Payne went to.
Could well be. Could easily well be. I don't know. What do you think, Don? You think people will buy only on the internet?
Yes. They're doing it today. You can buy a car on Amazon and make no darkening of a dealer's door until you sign the paper and drive away. Because for a lot of people, dealerships are worse than dental offices. They don't want anything to do with it. They don't want to be sold polyglycode and upholstery covers and extended warranties. They abhor the whole sales experience, and I think that's part of what Musk tried to disrupt. And he started it, and it's going, and I think it will continue.
Well, there's all kinds of car services like that now.
Yeah.
Carvana, they'll bring it to your house and all that. But in Elon's case, I think the whole Tesla thing is really crumbling, I believe.
We'll see. I mean, you could well be right. I think we got to wait a few more months to see how things are going in Europe, where they've just started to allocate production. See what happens in China. They put a stop on the sales. I don't know. There's some hiccup with the Chinese.
Apparently, it just had to do with label registration numbers, and that's been resolved.
Resolved? Okay.
Yeah. Well, what about the runaway quality issues?
I think they're getting their quality issues under control. And, you know, there was a lot of fit and finish issues. Look, you know, they rushed the Model 3 to production. They didn't have anything ready yet. But it seems to be that they've gotten those issues largely resolved. But getting back to your point, Peter, I still think you need a store to go look at cars. You're right, Don. Some people will just buy online, sight unseen, and take the risk. I think for a lot of people, they want to go kick tires, so to speak. When it comes to service and the like, too, Henry Payne wrote a great article in the Detroit News. He had a sensor that got knocked out by a rock on the front fender or the front bumper. It took 2 months for the mobile service repair unit to show up. Now, Musk has addressed that, too, that he's going to really ramp up service. But I still think when it comes to buying for most people, if you really want to open up the market for Tesla, you got to have some stores where people can go see and at least test drive the cars. I said something about this earlier on Out of Line Daily, and somebody wrote in to say, look, you can buy a Tesla and they'll let you drive, I think it is 1,000 miles.
I thought it was a week.
It's a week.
And
get capped
miles.
At 1,000. Okay, let's say it's a week. And if you don't like the car, you can give it back sight unseen. But most people are not going to want to buy a car to see if they really like it. They want to do a test drive and then say, no, this isn't for me, or it is for me. So, I get the feeling that Musk has said, I got to close stores so I can come out with the $37,000 priced car.
$35,000 priced car.
Well, okay, $35,000 then. That smacks to me of desperation. Geez, I can only get the cost down if I get rid of all these people and close all these stores.
And get $6 million for the land. I mean, for each one of these places. Think about that for a minute. I mean, it just, at first I thought this is insane, but I'm sure that that real estate is highly valuable. And but it's interesting, if he does have the $35,000 car, it suddenly makes it cheaper than an Audi A4 or a Mercedes E-Class or a BMW 3 Series. He undercuts all of them.
We'll see. I mean, I'd love to see Tesla succeed. I think what they've achieved so far is really impressive from a product standpoint, not from this corporate entity that is something of a monetary shell game, but the product, I'm pretty impressed with it.
I like the products. I've said for ages that they will fail from a business standpoint and be absorbed by some grander maker, maybe FCA. FCA needs to catch up on electrification. It would be a rather straightforward move for them to absorb Tesla and maybe keep the name and boot Elon.
What about battery electric vehicle performance in cold weather?
Well, it's an issue,
yeah,
clearly.
It's like it cuts your range in half.
It does. But, you know, it's all going to depend on how much do you have to drive every day.
Right.
I think most people drive, what's the stat, 40 to 50 miles a day.
Yeah. I mean, electrics in urban areas, sure.
Right.
But if you want to get in your car and drive to Elkhart Lake, which is about 8.5 hours.
You're not going to take the electric.
You aren't going to take the electric.
Even with fast chargers.
Ask Harry. I would like to challenge Harry on that subject to do a cross-country trip. I've got a millennial son who owns a Bolt. He's the term range anxiety has never registered on him whatsoever. And he's you know, I worried about him getting stuck with a dead battery and having to flatbed at home, but he doesn't use it city to city, just uses it local, but he's never had a hint of concern over its. And yeah, but 230, if it's 238 full charge, half of that's 119. He doesn't drive 119 any day.
And besides, he got a garage he plugs in every night?
Not a garage. He plugs in once a week because he doesn't have to do it every night.
But my point is, that's one of the beauties of electric cars, if you got a garage or an outlet, especially if it's a 220, is you leave the house every morning with a full tank, so to speak.
You have to. You're going to have your own charging, obviously. And the next step in that disruption, and Musk has previewed this also, is solar on the roof to cut your bill and, maybe even finance both of those things. The solar, the charger installation, the wiring, and the electric car as a package deal.
Yeah, solar on the roof of your home, not on the roof of the car.
Correct.
Yeah.
Photovoltaic.
Yeah.
Solar helmet, that's your issue.
Hey, look, we've burned up an hour here. We're going to have to wrap this up. But Don Sherman, thanks so much for coming on the show. Really interesting stuff about the C8.
Didn't even hurt.
Yeah, that's great.
So Peter, 11 months from now? It's
deliveries in 11 months. Production. Sure.
The end of this year.
And introduction possibly at National Corvette Museum anniversary time, end of August. This is just my speculation. And the plan is a four-letter word. Today's plan will be different in a week. So I'm just reporting what I believe is today's plan.
Peter, thanks for coming on.
Good to be
here. Good to hear you. And Gary, good being with you. We'll have to do this again.
Yeah.
Real good. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, outofline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Out of Line Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line This Week. There's all that and much more at outofline.tv.
Or 100 if you want to blow your wad.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. I agree completely.
Well, look, they got away from the mid-size pickups, as they call them now, because they were afraid it was going to cannibalize the big ones where they make so much money. And then somebody spent enough time looking at the Toyota Tacoma and realized, man, they sell a lot of those. And that's when GM jumped in, and that forced everybody's hand. So to your point, to go one step below, then they're going to say, oh, but that's going to cannibalize the mid-size one.
I remember when we used to live in a world of small Japanese pickups.
Right.
They were everywhere.
And they were good.
Yeah.
Rangers are nice little cheap pickups, too, used Rangers. That's, you know, I think Hyundai or Kia will do it before others and make a killing and make it cheap. You know, start below 20K. You don't sell many that way. As soon as you get the four-wheel drive and stuff, you're proud in 30.
Well, but so we saw the concept for the Hyundai Santa Cruz, which was basically that principle. But the thing that I wonder about is that more ridgeline than it is pickup truck. And so the question is, does somebody just say, you know what, we're just going to go back to, you know, meat and potatoes, you know, just
well, I think
get
that's
the press breakout and
that's coming.
That sheet metal.
Some manufacturer is going to come up with a car or truck that all in is 20 grand that will actually be desirable.
Trumpchi.
Yeah, but what you need is a small body on frame with a half ton to a three quarter ton capability, not sold as a lifestyle vehicle, but as a true hardcore truck. And don't overstyle it. And people will latch on to that. It'll become hot. It's funny how vehicles that are just basic, pure, and simple, like the Scion B, if you remember that.
XB.
You know, as soon as they said, oh, look, everybody's buying it, now we have to style a new one, the sales went in the toilet. And, you know, there's a loyal base of the old Ranger.
Why do you want body on frame, though?
Yeah.
Why do you want body on frame?
Because that's how you get the real durability. And I believe it's actually cheaper
do you
to
get,
make.
That's what I would ask you. Is it really cheaper? Why is it cheaper?
Because when you have a unit body, my understanding is, I'm not an engineer, I've never designed one. I mean, everything's a stressed member in there. And it just seems to me that it's a lot more complicated than having a basic ladder frame that you can drop any kind of a body on that you want. And where the frame can take so much of the crash, not the whole body. And in fact, you know, everyone's, you know, going gaga now over the skateboard. Everyone's talking, ooh, the skateboard. What's the skateboard? Skateboard's body on frame.
Effectively. But they didn't go gaga when Larry Burns showed it long ago.
That's right.
Well, they did, actually.
I did. I thought it was pretty
cool. Yeah, I thought it was way cool. And it got a lot of attention, and then GM didn't do anything with it. And then Tesla came out,
the technology,
and then Faraday and Lucid, and all, they're all doing
flies. I just want you to know that
body on frame that they don't want to call it body on frame because that goes back 100 years ago. So they call it the skateboard, which is what GM called it. Chris Baroni Burden,
mm-hmm. Yep,
who I'm having coffee with tomorrow.
If I was running GM, as soon as the C8 came out, I would make a Corvette SS available, C7, but there'd be no options. It'd be all packaged for the enthusiasts and then price it at like $48,000.
Well, the original Z06 was a stripper survivor Corvette. Look at the wonder and beauty of that. That was a brilliant move.
Yeah.
Here's a picture of Larry Burns with the skateboard.
I'll never forget that press intro.
Yeah.
It silently came out. I thought it was cool.
No, totally. Hub motors, battery built into the skateboard structure. Everything's there. Steering, braking, powertrain, drivetrain. It's pretty smart.
And you got that essential elevated H point that women insist upon.
Not just women, but...
aging population.
Aging population.
It's easier to step in and out than it is to lower your ass in that.
I'm aging. I don't mind falling in place.
Depends how much you have to fall. And if you're doing it every single day. It's one thing to have a toy for fun driving. It's another thing to get in and out of that car every single day. In fact, for some people, multiple times.
Doing errands and stuff, I mean, you know. I mean, doing errands the other day in my Gallardo, it was a pain.
Real good. Well,
yeah, this is good.